I want to talk about history, of course, and I want to talk about now, because I'd never wanted to separate the two. I didn't get into history because I wanted to be a professional historian. You know, I didn't want to just write for scholarly journals and go to annual meetings of the American Historical Association. You can imagine how fascinating that is. I went into history with sort of a very modest aim. I wanted to change the world. I'm only partway there. But with your help. But I never wanted to be the kind of historian who, you know, you spend a semester or a year with a teacher and you never know where that teacher stands on the issues of the day. I did not want to be a neutral teacher. I didn't want to be a so-called objective teacher. I wanted my students to know exactly where I stood on whatever is going on in the world. I didn't want to go into the past and get lost. And, you know, that happens. You know, there are historians who go into the past. It's very interesting there. Then you never hear from them again. So, no, I wanted to go into history, and I wanted to come out with something that would be useful, something that would throw some light on what was going on in the world. I suppose the reason for this approach, the reason for this, you know, peculiar notion about history, was that, well, I'd lived a certain kind of life before I became a historian, before I even went to college. I had 10 years between high school and college. That should encourage some of you. There's a lot you can learn if you don't go to school. At the age of 18, I didn't go to college. I went to work in a shipyard. I was a shipyard worker for 3 years. In the working class neighborhood that I grew up in, a working class family, kids did not go to college at the age of 18. They went to work. And that's what I did. So I worked in a shipyard for 3 years, and I guess I developed there a kind of class consciousness. Do you know what I mean? A consciousness that the United States is not one big happy family. You know? It's very, very important to understand this because so many things in our culture want to tell us, you know, that we all have the same interests. You know, if Bush says, we're going to get a tax cut, great. We're all going to get a tax cut. No. No. You know, it's the culture uses phrases like the national interest, as if there's a national interest, as if there isn't, you know, General Electric's interest and my interest, you see. Well, no. Or they use the term national security as if we all have the same notion of what national security means. For some people up there, national security means having more military bases around the world. For other people, national security means health care, housing, jobs, living a decent life. That's what security is. When you work at a hard job and you look around and later on in life, if you run into people as I did, when I was teaching at Boston University, I had a lot of my students were the children of, you might say, successful people, professional people, you know, business people, doctors, lawyers. A lot of my students, and a number of them would say, not all of them, but a number of them would say, Well, because we'd always have a discussion in my class about class. And some of my students would say, well, in America, if you work hard, you will make it. If you work hard, you will be successful. If you work hard, you know. I knew this was not true. You know, I knew how hard my father had worked. I knew how hard my mother had worked. And no, they didn't make it in the normal sense of what success is. No. And on the other hand, I saw people, I didn't really meet them myself. I saw them in the movies. I saw them in the magazine covers and people who were rich and prosperous, and I couldn't tell what kind of work they did. And I early on decided that, the society is divided into classes. You know, there are people who work very, very hard and make very, very little, you know, and there are people who don't work very hard. Or if they work, sometimes you find out their work is not good for the rest of us. They produce dangerous things. So when I began to study history, I came to history with this kind of consciousness. And I knew that the 55 men who gathered in Philadelphia to draw up the Constitution did not represent the American people. They were rich white men. You know, it was not, this was not a multicultural group. No, this, there were no women there. There were no black people there. There were no Native Americans there. There were no poor people there. And they did not draw up a constitution to benefit everybody. There's a great, I have a tendency in our society to make big deals of things that are little deals. We make big deals of the Constitution. In the year 1987, some of you who are old enough to remember it, that was 1987. I know all you high school kids remember that year, 1987. And it was the year of the bicentennial of the Constitution, 200 years after 1787, right? So there's a big celebration. All over the country, there were all these, all this hullabaloo about the Constitution. What a wonderful, wonderful document it was. And the president at that time, you may vaguely remember him, Ronald Reagan, the president, please. He's Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was so overcome by the Constitution that he wrote an essay. Hard to believe, right? He wrote an essay for some, scholarly publication. I think it was Parade magazine. In it, he wrote that the Constitution is such a perfect document, it could only have been written with the guiding hand of God. That's awesome. God. God took time out of her busy schedule to say, to fashion the Constitution of the United States. What hubris, what arrogance. We still have that. God, is on our side. Listen to Bob Dylan's poem, a song, right? With God on our side. Really, go back and find it. Find Dylan's song, With God on Our Side. There was that year when Reagan wrote that wonderful essay. That year, there was only one dissenting voice in the upper reaches of the American government about the Constitution, and that was the voice of the one black member of the Supreme Court, Thurgood Marshall. And he made a speech. he made a speech in which he said, in effect, "What are you all getting excited about? The Constitution was a pro-slavery document," which is what it was, of course. The Constitution legitimized slavery. The Constitution had a provision for the return of fugitive slaves to their masters wherever they were apprehended in the country. The Constitution considered black slaves as 3/5 of a person. This is, you know, no. The Constitution did not represent all of us, all of the American people. The Constitution was drawn up to serve the class interests of the people who were there in Philadelphia. It was drawn up to serve the interests of the slave owners and the bondholders and the merchants and the expansionists, to set up a strong central government. You know, at first, I remember going to school and saying, a strong central government, that's good. Well, it depends. It depends on what the government does with that strength. You know, it's like today, the United States is, oh, a very, very powerful country. That's wonderful to live in such a very powerful country. Really? Depends on what this country does with that power. No. And what the Constitution wanted the government to do with this new strong central power was to make sure it was able to put down rebellions and revolts. Because the year before the making of the Constitution, and you won't hear this connection made, I assure you, in most schools. I'm not talking about the schools that you go to, but I know. But those other schools. Generally, in the schools of this country, you will not hear the connection made between Shays' Rebellion, the rebellion of farmers in western Massachusetts, and the making of the Constitution. As some of you may recall Shays' Rebellion, like it was on a multiple choice test or something, you know. It was a rebellion of thousands and thousands of farmers in western Massachusetts in 1786, rebelling against the rich of Massachusetts who controlled the legislature. Many of them were veterans of the Revolutionary War, and they'd been given pieces of land, and now that land is being taxed heavily, and they couldn't pay the taxes, and so their land and their farms were being taken away from them. They were being mortgaged away, and so they gathered around the courthouses in thousands, and they would not let the court proceedings go on. They did it in town after town after town. That was Shays' Rebellion. Finally, it was crushed by the army sent out, you know, from Boston. But it put a scare into the Founding Fathers. And the Founding Fathers decided, no, we have to have a government that's strong enough to put down rebellion. And so that was the idea of having a new, strong, central government. Interestingly enough, the veterans of the Revolutionary War got the same treatment that veterans of wars get. Talk about connecting the past and the present. You can find a persistent thread from the Revolutionary War to the Gulf War, going through all the other wars, of the betrayal of veterans. They come back from the war, they've been given great promises, and then they find the government is not going to take care of them, and the government, you know, is going to not fulfill the promises it made. And this is what veterans have found out again and again. The veterans of World War I were promised a bonus, and when the Depression hit in the early 1930s, the veterans desperately needed that bonus that had been promised by Congress, and it was not there. The kids did not have enough to eat. And so veterans from all over the country traveled to Washington, came from all over the country. They They rode the rails, they walked, they got here in Washington by hook or crook, and they set up tents across the Potomac River from the Capitol to demand that Congress pay their bonus. Congress wouldn't do it. Instead, the army was sent out to break up their tent colony, to spread tear gas, to shoot and drive them away. And what happened to the veterans of Vietnam who developed Agent Orange as a result of the chemical spray that the United States Army was using in Vietnam? And hundreds of thousands of veterans. And what happened to the veterans of the Gulf War? They say, oh, well, we only lost 200 men in the first Gulf War in 1991. But after the Gulf War, 550,000 soldiers received disability benefits from the Veterans Administration for injuries and sickness that came as a result of that war. And what is, and how are they going to treat the veterans of this war who are already getting sick? You're not hearing that story very much in the papers, but there's sickness among the GIs in Iraq. Well, of course there's sickness. With all of that high technological chemical stuff that we're using, depleted uranium, radioactive materials, is it any wonder that these GIs are coming back sick? And what is going to happen to them? So yes, I want to draw a connection, and I want to show the persistence of certain things over time. The treatment of veterans, the class character of the government, the government of slave owners and merchants and manufacturers, even after slavery was done away with, that still remained a government of the very rich, and it remains a government of the very rich today. And the interests, nobody can tell me that the interests of George Bush and the interests of most of the American people are the same. Those kids who go to your school, you mentioned, whose parents earn $12,000 a year, their interests are not the same as the interests of the people in the White House. And so we can't expect those people in the White House to care about what happens to the ordinary people of this country. So yes, history can be useful. History can suggest things to us about what is going on today. If you don't know any history, it's as if you were born yesterday. If you were born yesterday and the president gets up before a microphone and says, we must go to war for democracy, for liberty, to liberate these people in this other country. If you don't have any history, if you were born yesterday, well, you have no way of checking up on this. Oh, you will believe the president. He's the president. He knows. Well, if you knew some history, you would know how often it turned out the presidents didn't know. Or if they knew, they didn't care. And so, yes, you have to know the history of the United States. If you hear the president say, you know, we're occupying Iraq to liberate the people and to create democracy there. Sounds reasonable if you have no history. If you know some history and you look back over the history of American occupations and American military interventions, and you see how often we have brought democracy and liberty to those countries we have invaded and occupied. No. If the American people as a whole knew this history, Bush would be out on his ear in 5 minutes. Really? No. Well, just a little slice of that history, which I can't resist. In 1898, the United States went to war in Cuba against Spain. Spanish-American War. Why did we go in? To liberate the Cubans from Spanish rule. Really? That's what we said. And it's true that the Cubans were suffering under Spanish rule, just as the Iraqis were suffering under Saddam Hussein. So we go in to Cuba and drive the Spaniards out and drive ourselves in. Spain is out, we are in. Spain is out, and the American corporations rush into Cuba. United Fruit, the American banks, the American railroads, and from that point on, Cuba is virtually a colony of the United States. When I hear that, oh, the United States is writing a constitution for Cuba, that's a laugh. You know, we are writing a constitution for Cuba? We're not even observing our own constitution. And besides, since when does having a constitution guarantee liberty and democracy? It's always a way of deceiving people. You know, you write out a document and you give it to them and you say, now you have democracy. And we made sure that we wrote important provisions into the Cuban Constitution in 1898. Yeah, we wrote a provision in guaranteeing that the United States could send the army into Cuba anytime it felt like. We wrote a provision in for the United States to establish a military base in Cuba, which we still have today. I mean, that's what Guantanamo is, a military base that the United States has had for over 100 years. We did not bring democracy to Cuba. For 100 years, Cuba had, for a long, long time, Cuba, well, let's say 70 years. Cuba lived under dictatorship with American corporations profiteering in Cuba, with the rich Americans going to Cuba for gambling and prostitution. And I mean, that's what Cuba was. That's how much democracy and liberation we brought to Cuba. Unfortunately, then, Castro came and ruined it all. You know. And that's what we had against him. He ruined it all. You know, it was a wonderful playground for Americans. And now they've taken away the seesaws. You know. So, I won't talk about the American occupation of Haiti or the American occupation of the Dominican Republic, or the American occupation of the Philippines, which lasted 46 years, and we're still not out of there. No, our record as an occupying power, you know, is not a record that we can be proud of. And so if you knew that history and listened to the President of the United States, you know, forget it. No. There must be other motives. Really? You mean there could be other motives? You mean the United States could have motives other than liberty and democracy in sending its armies around the world? A little history would be helpful there. Yeah. Take Vietnam. We go into Vietnam to bring liberty and democracy to the people of Vietnam. Well, if you read the memos that were sent secretly in the high echelons of government, from the State Department to the National Security Council and back, these things came out when the Pentagon Papers were illegally released in an act of civil disobedience in 1971. And you could read those memos in the Pentagon Papers. And what are those memos say when they talked about why the United States was in Vietnam? They didn't talk about liberty and democracy. They talked about tin, rubber, and oil. And it doesn't take too much investigation to come to the conclusion that behind all this talk about liberty and democracy, behind all this talk is oil, business, profits. Not the security of the people of Iraq, and certainly not the security of the United States. This occupation of Iraq is a very brutal occupation. The American people are only getting a little bit of the sense of what that occupation is like. Back in World War II, we talked about the Nazis occupying the countries of Europe. I mean, we talked right after that about the Russians occupying, you know, Hungary and Czechoslovakia and so on. Those occupations, were bad. Our occupations, are good. But if you read, just occasionally it comes in the press about things that happen, in this occupation. CBS News, and you have to read carefully, because these things that give you a glimpse of the truth, they appear and they disappear, really. And they appear and disappear so quickly, 2 days later, you're not even sure you really read it, So you have to be a clipper of newspapers, like I am. You have to, fiendishly cut up all the stuff from the papers and put it in your files so you won't think it never happened, you see. And CBS reported, July of this year, Amnesty International is looking into a number of cases of suspected torture in Iraq by American authorities. One such case involves Raisan al-Abali. His house was razed by American soldiers who came in shooting and arrested him and his 80-year-old father. They shot and wounded his brother. The three men were taken away. Raisan says his interrogators stripped him naked and kept him awake for more than a week, either standing or on his knees, bound hand and foot with a bag over his head. Raisan told his captors, "I don't know anything. I don't know what you want. I have no idea what you want. I have nothing. I asked them to kill me." After 8 days, they let him and his father go. U.S. officials did not respond to repeated requests to discuss the case. And you may remember that the United States government put out a most wanted list, and they had playing cards to represent, the top Iraqi leaders, Saddam Hussein and his sons and other, and they had playing cards representing them. It's a lot of fun, war, you say. And the playing cards, were headed, most wanted. These are wanted. Well, somebody interviewed a soldier in Iraq with the 101st Airborne. He said, "I have my most wanted list. I have my playing cards, And he says, "My playing cards have the pictures of Donald Rumsfeld, George Bush, Paul Wolfowitz, Paul Bremer." So that's an occupation. Not something we Americans could be proud of. We don't want to live in a country where our government and our army and our soldiers do these things. And soldiers follow orders, and they do these things. Ordinary guys go into the military, and the military does a job on their heads, and they end up doing terrible things. I was in the military, I was in the Air Force. Did I tell you that? I will. I was in the Air Force. And let's see, what war was that? with the Spanish-American War. It was World War II. No, not the Spanish-American War. But I know what happens to people in the military, and the training that you get until you're not thinking for yourselves anymore, and then they just tell you to go out, and bomb this place, and you have no idea what you're doing. Have no idea what you're bombing. You don't know who's dying down there. You're you're dropping bombs from 30,000 feet, from 6 miles up in the air. You don't see any human beings down below. You don't hear any screams. You don't see any blood. You don't see any mangled limbs. And so you go and you do all of this and you come back. Ah, yeah, successful mission. You may remember during the first Gulf War, they show, you know, pictures on television of pilots coming back happily. Oh, yeah, we succeeded here. We dropped our bombs here. Mission accomplished. No, but they had no idea, you know, what they were doing. They didn't see these people up close. No. There's one picture that I clipped from the newspaper. It shows this Iraqi kid who is an Iraqi boy in a hospital, and lost both of his legs in a bomb strike yesterday. This is from the New York Times, you know, in April. So this is what occupation means. This is what war means. They're talking about a war on terrorism, which is ridiculous. This has not been a war on terrorism. This has been a war to increase terrorism. Because the more you bomb a country and the more you subject its people to humiliation, the more terrorists you create. And war itself is terrorism. So if we could only get that message across to people that war is terrorism. If terrorism is defined by the deliberate killing of innocent people in order to achieve some objective, some political objective, you know, I mean that's what terrorists do. Well, then that's what governments do. They'll say, oh, it's not deliberate. We don't mean to kill these people, just an accident. An accident after accident after accident after accident, you know. No, it's not an accident. That doesn't mean it's deliberate. It does not mean that the pilot wants to kill these kids, these people down below. It just means that he doesn't really care. He's just going to do his job. It's going to be inevitable. No matter how so-called smart the bomb is, inevitable that civilians will be killed. How come we dropped all those smart bombs in Afghanistan and killed over 3,000 civilians? How come we dropped all these smart precision bombs in Iraq and have killed we don't know how many civilians, 5,000, 10,000, in a very short time? No. That's terrorism. And we stand against terrorism committed against us, and we can stand against terrorism committed by us. No. I think one of the most important things for people to learn is to go beyond the nationalism that we're all brought up with. You know, the idea that, you know, we are the greatest. You know, we are number one. We should be proud that we are the strongest. We are the toughest. You know, we have the most nuclear weapons. We have the most military bases everywhere. That's something to be proud of, really. No, no. If we were number one in health care, that would be something to be proud of. You see, no. No. If we were number one in giving our billions, not for war, but for people in Africa who need drugs to combat malaria and tuberculosis, that's what we should be number one in. We shouldn't want to be number one as a military superpower. We should want to be number one as a humanitarian superpower. That's what we should be doing. No. When I say overcome nationalism, you know, we're imbued with it from the time we're this high. We go to school and we pledge allegiance to the flag. You know, and then recruiters come around to the high schools and they show all these movies and on television and so on about military heroism. And so it's no wonder the kids grow up thinking, wow, this is a great thing to do. Go to war. Become a military hero. And get the idea that somehow we are better than other people. Get the idea that the lives of our people are more important than the lives of other people. Our job in education, I say this to teachers, I say this to students, our job in education, there's nothing more important we can do than get across the idea that the lives of children everywhere are worth the same. That the lives of, if we knew that, if we felt that, if we believed that, we could never have dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We could never have done that. We could never kill 200,000 people, old people, kids, all people living in two cities. We could never kill several hundred thousand of those people because we say, oh, well, we needed to do it to win the war. Actually, we didn't need to do it to win the war. I've done a lot of research on that, and I assure you, no, we didn't need to do that to win the war. We may have had other motives in mind. Motives in which killing a couple hundred thousand people didn't matter so much as telling the world, we have these bombs, and don't forget it, really. Somebody tells you, well, we had to do it, it's a shame. This is what I always say. Oh, we don't like the fact that we have to kill all these people. But, we had to do it to win the war. To win the war faster, because we knew Japan had already lost the war, but to win it faster, we're going to kill a couple hundred thousand people. Here's what you say to those people. I like to tell people what to say. Okay, here we are, August 1945. We could end the war more quickly by killing 100,000 American children. How about it? Would anybody say yes? No, I don't think so. Oh, well, but you're willing to kill 100,000 Japanese children to end the war quickly. What does that mean? It means that you don't consider Japanese children's lives as important as American lives. We have to get over that. We have to establish a principle in this world. We have to establish true globalization. You say, all people everywhere are the same. The Declaration of Independence promises equality and liberty, the right to pursue happiness for the people in the United States. It should promise it for people all over the world, you see. When I left the Air Force, I'm taking you through my life, month by month. Won't take long. I left the Air Force. I knocked around for a few years at terrible jobs, got married, had a few kids. I don't know how many. I decided to go to school, college, under the GI Bill. Study history. Yeah. Well, just as I told you before, I knew by this time why I wanted to study history. I was interested in class conflict and class. I was interested in war because I had decided, even after participating in what was supposed to be called the Good War, World War II. You know, they keep showing us all these World War II movies, Saving Private Ryan, and all these movies about the heroism of D-Day and the 101st and the 102nd and so on. The Good War. They're trying to take the aura of World War II, the Good War, and plaster it over every ugly war we have fought since then. That's what they're trying to do. I resent that. But I came out of the Good War thinking and thinking and thinking and coming to the conclusion that war solves no fundamental problems. It may seem to. It's like a quick fix. Oh, we got rid of Hitler. Oh, we got rid of Mussolini. Did we get rid of war? Did we get rid of fascism in the world? Did we get rid of racism or militarism in the world? Look at the world after we expended 50 million lives in that good war, and look at what the world is like after that, war after war after war. And people oppressed and people hungry all over the world. No, a war is not a solution to any fundamental problems. That's the conclusion I came to. If we are going to do something about tyranny, yes, there are problems in the world, aggression, tyranny. We have to use the enormous ingenuity that human beings have. Now, we're very smart. We can build jet airplanes. We can send people to the moon. We can do computers. We're very smart and very dumb, right? But we have to use that smart part of us to figure out how to solve the social problems of the world without killing large numbers of people in war. That's our problem, you see. So I went to school under the GI Bill. And then I graduated. I got through that fast, right? Very quick, concentrated program. 2 minutes. Graduated, did graduate work, got a PhD, right? First teaching job, Spelman College, Atlanta, Georgia, a black women's college in Atlanta. Okay? So I spent 7 years, wife, kids, 7 years in Atlanta, Georgia, between 1956 and 1963. You know, time of the movement, what is called the civil rights movement, the black movement against racial segregation. And here I was teaching in a black college, women's college, we living in a black community. And of course, I had to get involved. I couldn't stay in the classroom while my students are out getting arrested, while students are demonstrating. My students would be out demonstrating, sitting in, and I would stay in the classroom and teach about liberty and democracy. You know, that was ridiculous. You know. So I joined them, I became involved, and I left Atlanta, went down to Albany, Georgia, where demonstrations were taking place. I went to Selma, Alabama, and Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and Jackson, and, you know. That's what I did for the next several years, you know. And I learned so much during those years, being involved in the movement, being involved with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. I learned so much in those years. Well, for one thing, I learned to look at history from a black point of view. You know, history is different when you look at it from the point of view of black people. It's different when you look at it from the viewpoint of Native American people. Different when you look at it from the standpoint of women. It's just different, you know. And when you look at the history of, from the point of view of black people, the heroes are different. even the names of eras turn out not to be quite accurate. You know, the progressive era, it's called. The first years of the 20th century, because some reforms were passed. Progressive era were those years in which more black people were lynched than in any other period in American history. You know, look at history from the standpoint of Indians. The Civil War, war for liberation. In the midst of the Civil War, more land is taken from the Indians out west than any comparable period in American history. Do you learn that when you learn about the Civil War? And I doubt it. But so I learned a lot about looking at history from different points of view. But probably the most important thing I learned was the power of ordinary people. Because racial segregation in the South was so deeply entrenched. Black people in the South seemed powerless. They had nobody in office. They had no policemen. They had no... everybody was... all the people in power were white. And there was the white business structure. And not only that, but the federal government was in collaboration with the Southern segregationists maintaining racial segregation. A lot of people thought, you know, this was a common idea among Northerners. Oh, there's racism in the South and liberalism in the North. Not so. You know, the federal government did not enforce for almost 100 years the 14th and 15th Amendments of the Constitution. For almost 100 years, every president of the United States violated his oath of office, because the president pledges when he takes office that he will see to it that the laws are faithfully executed. The 14th Amendment, which equal protection of the laws, the 15th Amendment, right to vote regardless of race or color. The federal government, the president, did not enforce these laws for almost 100 years. And they did not become enforced until black people rose up, starting small, starting with some sit-ins in Greensboro, North Carolina, spreading to other states in the South, and the freedom rides, and then the demonstrations growing and growing and growing all over the South, and thousands and tens of thousands of people going to prison. And a commotion then created in the nation, a commotion which was then heard all over the country and around the world. And only then did the national government, only then did Congress finally come through and, you know, enact a Civil Rights Act and a Voting Rights Act. But what I learned was that people who apparently don't have any power and who apparently face enormous power, these powerless people have enormous power once they get together, once they organize, once they speak out, act out, set an example for others, and give courage to other people by what they do, and they persist, and they're willing to take risks, and they're willing to go to jail, and they're willing to get beaten, and some of them are going to get killed. But if they persist and persist, this great power that seems unbeatable will finally collapse. And that's what happened in the South. And the South changed. And that has happened in other places in this country where it seemed that, you know, they have the power and we can't do anything. In the 1930s, the Depression, working people, hard time. And they decided to organize the workers of General Motors and Ford in order to get a little higher wage and shorter hours. And people said, you can't go up against General Motors. You can't go up against Ford. These are very powerful corporations, and they have the government on their side, because the government is always on the side of the rich. I'm sorry to say that. It's embarrassing to say that. But it's true. Well, maybe not always. Occasionally, when people put up a big enough fuss and people put up enough pressure, the government finally will do something on behalf of poor people, which is what happened in the 1930s. But what happened is that the workers of Ford Motor Company, when they got together and they went out on strike, and the plant couldn't operate, it didn't matter how much power, how much money Henry Ford had. Eventually, he had to give in. Eventually, General Motors had to give in. You know, when the workers sat in the factories and wouldn't let the factories go on, the famous sit-down strikes of 1936, 1937. What I learned in the South was that powerless people have enormous power. What I learned was that you do little things that you think aren't going to go anywhere, that you think aren't going to have any effect. But if you keep doing them, you will soon find that other people are doing them too. And at certain points in history, all these thousands and thousands of little acts that take place, because people have faith and they continue, at a certain point in history, they all come together and you have a great social movement and something changes the society. And we've seen this happen, you see. And it's at that point that democracy comes alive. Democracy is not the Constitution. Democracy is not the three branches of government. It's not checks and balances. And no, that's not what democracy is. Not what your teacher puts on the blackboard in junior high school, this diagram of checks and balances and three branches of government. No, that's not democracy. Democracy comes alive when people organize, get together, when citizens with a common cause decide that they are going to do something about an injustice that is going on, or they're going to stop a war that is an immoral war, or when women decide that they've been maltreated enough and they want to be recognized, or when disabled people decide that they've been seen as invisible for too long and they've finally commit civil disobedience and raise a ruckus, and then finally Congress passes a law that will give them some benefits. That's when democracy comes alive. So we have... So we have, that's our problem today. We have to bring democracy alive. We're actually on our way with its beginning. There are people all over this country, just like there are people sitting, you know, here in this room. I don't know how many of you are, 13,400. Wherever you go in the country, I travel a lot, I go around the country. Wherever I go, however small the town, I mean, Los Angeles is not a small town, but you can go to Bozeman, Montana. I was in... Where was I? I never know where I am. I was in Kentucky. I was in a little town in Kentucky. I was in Moorhead, Kentucky. And there were 1,500, a group as large as this, 1,500 people in Moorhead, Kentucky in this auditorium. And I gave them a speech against the war. And they all gave me a terrific, terrific reception. I thought, wow. Yeah, there are people all over this country who really care, who don't want war, who want this to be a different kind of country, who want the enormous wealth of this country to be used to help people, not to kill people. There are people all over this country who want that. So we have the beginnings. You know, we have the beginnings of a great social movement. And it's up to all of us to participate, to do something. Find something very small. Find an organization in your community. Find some group that's doing something that you believe in. If you can't find such a group, invent one. But do something, you see. And if we all, if we all just keep on keeping on, things will change. We can actually change things. It's hard to believe that now. We can get rid of Bush. And we can create a social movement which will cause anyone who's in power, even some Democrat. We can have a movement which will cause anybody in power, even if they didn't intend it when they got into power, to begin to do the kinds of things that people want this country to do and have. So I leave you with that. Thank you very much. One thing. I just have to tell you this, okay? I don't like to be applauded. Only kidding. But, I just want to, say something about the use of the term un-American. I like the use of the term un-American. The term un-American assumes that the people who use it know what America is, or who America is, you see. And, the term American is one of those terms which is intended to befog our minds. You know, what is American and what is un-American and who represents America and who doesn't represent America? You mean if you criticize the government of the United States, you're criticizing America? No. Is Bush an American in the same sense that we are Americans? We are Americans as much as Bush is America. More. Right? There are these, abstractions, America, the country, and you hear Sometimes you will see on television these young guys going off to war, and a television reporter is talking to them, says, tell me, son, a young man, young woman, why are you going off? And the person said, well, I'm willing to serve my country. Country? No. You go to war, you're not serving your country. You're serving a small group of people who will profit from this war. Not serving your country. You know. You're not serving America. America is not the government. You know, there's a distinction between the government and the country, between the government and the people of the country. And this goes back to the Declaration of Independence. The basic philosophy that is expressed in the Declaration of Independence is that governments are artificial creations set up by the people to ensure certain rights, equality, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Governments are set up to do that. And when they don't do that, when governments become destructive of those ends, that's the language of the Declaration, then, again, according to the Declaration, is the duty of the people to alter or abolish the government. You see. Okay. The Declaration, the Declaration of Independence is a patriotic document, you say. And the idea that you're being unpatriotic when you criticize the government means that you don't understand what democracy is. You don't understand the distinction between the government and the country. We who oppose war, we who criticize the government, we stand for the interests of the people in the country. We stand for the principles of the Declaration of Independence. That is patriotic. So again, I'm going to keep going. Okay.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and as CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD, or you can download it for free at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the digit 4, all.net. If you valued what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized, democratic civic media. Thanks very much for listening.